Great. So I'm going to take us to Zimbabwe, so very different cultural context. And we have a great team both here in the U.S. and in Zim that we work with. No relationships to disclose. So Zimbabwe is southern Africa. Some of you are probably really familiar with it, and some of you not so much. The area we have worked in, my point, yes. See, you can see Harare up here, which is the major city, and the community we work in is Chitungwiza, which is a sort of suburb, I would say, by African standards. It's fairly rural by American standards. So I think, you know, many of you are very familiar probably with these statistics. Intimate partner violence, violence against women, very, very high worldwide. Zimbabwe is one of the highest, with around 63% of women reporting, you know, sometime in their life experiencing violence, and Japan, of course, being the highest, which is a conversation for a different day. So HIV and violence are very deeply intertwined. Clearly, you know, having experienced sexual violence, sexual coercion is a risk factor for HIV. But also being HIV infected is a risk factor for experiencing coercion and violence as well. So you end up in this vicious cycle kind of situation. And of course, as everyone's spoken about, violence puts women at risk of all sorts of unintentional pregnancy, physical, mental health issues. HIV is also a risk factor for many of the same issues. So you again have women that really have a lot going on in their lives. This is a World Health Organization poster talking about the importance of violence and HIV being intertwined. So we looked at just what was going on in this population of women. This study, as I'll discuss in a minute, was nested in a larger interventional trial. The interventional trial was looking at uptake of family planning in this population. But we decided to look at just what was going on in terms of intimate partner violence as well, and possibly as cofactors. And then we were also really interested in IPV and HIV disclosure, and if that had an effect on if people were talking about HIV. As I mentioned, it was nested within an intervention trial that has been previously published. And we did find good results in that trial of getting HIV-infected women to uptake family planning methods. We worked in four public clinics in Chitungwiza, and we did face-to-face interviews, baseline 6 weeks, and 3 months post-intervention. And again, these are all HIV-positive women, and they were all pregnant when they entered our study. Again, the major trial was focused on family planning uptake. And we had 98 participants, so just under 100. We used the World Health Organization Violence Against Women Study Instrument that many of you are probably familiar with. It asks a lot of different categories and a lot of different questions about duration and timing. So at baseline, you see extremely high proportions of pretty much every kind of violence, certainly controlling behavior, almost 70% of the women experience, but also, you know, the emotional abuse, the moderate or severe physical violence. We actually thought the sexual violence number was a little low, but of course there's a lot of stigma about reporting that in particular, as everybody really has discussed, much more so than for physical violence. And that clearly is true worldwide. This is a sort of an appalling number to me, that 20% had experienced physical violence while pregnant. But so very, very high violence experiences. This, again, I think will be no surprise to anyone in here, but women experiencing any one kind of violence or controlling behavior were highly significantly likely to be experiencing a second or third kind. So a lot of these women were experiencing sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and physical abuse, or some combination of those two. Again, not surprising, but upsetting. And in particular, this controlling behavior question, which again is a World Health Organization construct, was highly associated with the lack of ability to talk about family planning, use condoms, that sort of thing. So again, we're seeing these risk factors piling up for HIV and mental health and unwanted pregnancy. So like I said, this was an intervention trial. This was not a primary outcome of the intervention trial. We were hoping we would see some effects on some of these with our trial because it did focus on gender pride and women's empowerment and having conversations with your partner, again, around family planning. But we were hoping we would affect some of these, and we really didn't, other than this fought back ever. But the numbers are very small there, you can see. So it's hard to draw a lot of conclusions on that. So like I said, we did just explore a little bit sort of intimate partner violence and HIV disclosure. And again, not surprisingly, you know, if you were experiencing controlling behavior, emotional abuse, the partners were much less likely to disclose HIV status to women. However, interestingly, women seemed to... it seemed to not have an effect on disclosure whether or not they were in a violent relationship. That may, again, reflect primarily sort of small numbers, and not a lot of people are having these disclosure conversations anyway in these relationships, partially because they lead to more violence sometimes. But so that was an interesting finding. So, of course, limitations. We all have limitations. This is not what we set out to study. It was a sub-study. It's all self-report, and we recruited from antenatal clinics, so this is an in-care population. Although in Zimbabwe, over 90% of women actually do seek some antenatal care, so it's fairly representative. So not surprisingly, you know, IPV is a huge problem in this HIV-infected population. You know, well over 75% reported at least one form of violence, and again, most of those were experiencing more than one. So, interestingly, this emotional abuse controlling behavior may increase your HIV risk because they're just not talking about HIV at all. And, of course, you know, we need interventions to deal with this issue. And certainly in Zimbabwe, policy changes as well. You know, I think there's been some discussion here about how policy, especially with yours, really can affect what goes on. And, you know, in Zimbabwe, it's... violence against women is very much part of the culture and the community, and there's not a lot of strong policy around it. There are some examples in sub-Saharan Africa, particularly Kenya, where there are some policies in place. They aren't always enforced, but at least it's a step in the right direction. So I wanted to talk a little bit, sort of end on a positive note, and I'm sure some of you here could talk even more about this, but some of the things we've seen that have been promising around intimate partner violence and violence against women and girls, you know, there's been some really good luck in low and middle income countries with economic empowerment. It's a little bit of a tricky issue. In some cultures, it actually seems to increase violence if it challenges the structural power norms, so you really have to know your cultural context. But there's been some really nice wins on it, especially, again, in sub-Saharan Africa. And research also shows that women are, if they are making money, are significantly more likely to spend it on household costs, children's costs, school fees, that sort of thing. So it really sort of brings up the whole family. There's been some newer data on empowerment and self-defense training, and this is a shameless plug on some level because I've been involved in some of this work in Kenya. Where, particularly with adolescents, we're doing empowerment and self-defense training with them. It seems to actually make a huge difference. Like, we're seeing like 50% drops in rates of sexual assault. And these are girls that are experiencing 20, 25% annual incidents of sexual assault in their school and home environment. So these are very high-risk groups of women. And we're looking now at some pregnancy-related dropouts. Seem to be decreasing as well with this sort of empowerment kind of intervention. So some really promising stuff there. And then this has been discussed some at this conference, but this bystander intervention kinds of programs seem to be really gaining some ground and being sort of, again, changing cultural norms around. One of you guys mentioned, you know, officers standing around and watching a woman be raped. So changing norms around that being okay and giving people tools to intervene. I'm sure you know the research sort of shows you have to both believe it's not okay and then feel like you can do something about it. So we're seeing some really promising work in the U.S. around that, and I think that's just beginning to move into the low and middle income country kinds of settings, but potentially really promising. And supporting broader social community change around what's acceptable and what's not. So I think that's exciting work. Of course, our participants, everybody in Zim, the ministries, you know, have been very supportive of this work. And and PEPFAR and NIH for sponsoring that research. Thank you very much.